Welcome to the Ogletree Deacons Podcast, a quick digest of compelling legal issues and practical insights delivered to you in less than 20 minutes.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another Ogletree Deacons Employment Law Podcast. My name is Bud Bobber. I'm a lawyer at the Ogletree office in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and I'm joined today by one of my excellent Milwaukee office colleagues, Mark Johnson. Mark, how you doing?
Good, Bud. Looking forward to it.
Yeah, thank you for doing this with me. Today, Mark and I are going to talk about seven questions that an employer should ask itself before firing an employee. And Mark, let me just start with a real simple or obvious seeming question, and that is about the concept of employment at will. You know, unless employees have an employment agreement, or unless they're covered by a labor contract, most employees in the U.S. are so-called employees at will. And doesn't that mean that the employer can fire them for any reason at all?
That's a good point, Bud, but there's two things to think about with that. First is that the exceptions to the employment at will doctrine have grown so vast that they really swallow the rule. Employees are protected from unfair discharge, if you want to call it that, by so many laws. The other thing to think about is that there's an unwritten rule in employment law that the employer needs to prove that they were fair to the employee. That's because courts and juries often may not really pay attention to the jury instructions or the law, and they may make their decisions based on their perceived notions of fairness. And they may think, well, that could be me sitting there in the plaintiff's box too. So I wish if it was me, I'd like to be treated fairly. So the seven questions we're going to talk about today are a good test to help you evaluate the risk of liability if there is such a case.
Yeah, and it's closer to art than science, but we thought that we should give employers this roadmap for assessing really what is ultimately the fairness of a termination decision. And we didn't make these up, right, Mark? These come from labor law, where under many labor contracts, a termination decision is judged against a standard of just cause.
Correct. But they apply really well to just about every context. All those exceptions to the employment at will doctrine, discrimination lawsuits, wrongful discharge claims, even unemployment claims.
Okay. And so with that, let's talk through the seven questions or the seven so-called elements of fair cause for a discharge. The first of these, Mark, it asks whether or not the employer gave the employee advance notice or warning of the prohibited behavior. Can you give us a little explanation about the advance notice element?
Sure. You want to be able to establish that the employee knew they could be terminated for the conduct they were terminated for. Plaintiff's lawyers love it if they can ask their client if they knew they were going to be fired, and the plaintiff says, no, I had no idea this was going to happen to me. But it's fairly easy to give advance notice. You can do it in an employee handbook or in a progressive discipline written warning. And the other thing I would say about this is that for the more serious misconduct, you probably don't need to give advance warning. If someone's going to be fighting or stealing from you, it's sort of common sense that the employee doesn't need to be warned expressly about that in advance.
Yeah, I think a real piece of conventional wisdom that all HR professionals hold on to is the notion that an employee should not be entirely surprised if they're getting fired, that they really should have had some advance notice or sense that they were performing or behaving in a way that was so unsatisfactory that their employment was in jeopardy. So let me move to the second question after the question of advance notice. The second question asks whether the company's rule or its policy or directive that the employee violated was one that was reasonable. And how should employers think about the reasonable rule question, Mark?
Well, the employer needs to be able to explain to a judge or a jury why the rule mattered. And that may be easy in some cases. You may have a rule against employees punching each other's time cards or against excessive absenteeism. It's easy to explain why that's important and to get the employee even to admit that that's a reasonable rule. There may be other cases, though, where it's not quite as clear. You may have a rule against call or that requires employees to call in for absences. And you may need to explain that if the employee texts a message in or emails a message and the employer receives it. And then in that sort of a situation, the employer may need to explain, well, here's why we need to insist on getting a call rather than a text or an email.
You know, and I like to think of this one as the obligation to explain that the rule or policy that we're enforcing really has an important business purpose. This isn't just whimsical. These aren't just rules that are imposed on employees for no reason. And people might think it's self-evident that if we have a rule or we have a policy that we're going to enforce potentially through firing people, that it would have a business purpose. But I find sometimes there's a disconnect in really big companies between a corporate directive that's established far away, maybe even in another country, as applied to a local facility that may have different rules and different past practices and really different norms of behavior. So one watch out for me and my clients, at least, is to make sure that we can establish that business purpose justification, even for those corporate directives that come to the local office or local factory from somewhere far away. And we've got to be able to connect those two things up. So let me move forward and take us to the third question on the list of seven. Did the employer make an effort to discover whether the employee in fact violated or disobeyed the rule or policy that we're talking about?
Yeah, that's a good thing to look into as well, because you don't want to just simply take somebody's word that an employee has violated a rule. You know, an example would be an employee comes to a production manager and says an employee has made excessive bad parts. Well, before you terminate that person for making too many bad parts, you really want to look into it and determine whether that's actually the case. If you don't, then the employee can always say that you were looking for a reason to get rid of them and you rushed to judgment and that there was something that you didn't know that you could have found out if you did investigate.
So that point, Mark, that you should be able to show that you investigated whether or not there really was a violation of a rule or a policy leads perfectly to the fourth question, which is, was the employer's investigation conducted fairly and objectively? And how does an employer go about demonstrating that its investigation was fair and objective?
Well, you want to make sure that you've consulted all the relevant witnesses, and that includes the person who's accused of violating the rule. You want to get their side of the story because you want to get it then rather than when you receive a complaint in a lawsuit or when you're hearing their testimony. And you also want to be careful about who does the investigation. Think about that and avoid someone who might be biased. We're seeing a lot of so-called cat's paw claims of discrimination where the person who makes the decision isn't biased, but the people who reported it or were part of the underlying investigation were. And so you want to try to avoid having that sort of a situation.
I think your point about being sure to interview the employee that's the target of the concern, I think that's really key because as Americans, we've got these built-in notions about due process, kind of comes out of the criminal justice system, but everybody believes it's entirely your right to be told what you did wrong, supposedly, what the allegation is, and to be asked for your side of the story. And like you said, we sure don't want to be hearing the terminated employee's side of the story for the first time when we're responding to an EEOC complaint or a court complaint and we're in litigation. That's something that we should have known before the decision was even made to fire that person. So let's talk about the fifth question, whether or not the employer obtained enough evidence or proof that the employee was guilty of some kind of misconduct or wrongdoing.
Sure. You need to sit back and think about if you had to go to court with your case or defend it before an administrative agency, what's the proof that you have? And that can involve thinking about, well, is it all hearsay? Do we have documents that back us up? What are the witnesses like? Are there reasons to maybe doubt the witnesses or doubt some of them in those sort of issues? You don't have to really have enough proof to win a court case at this point, but you should definitely think that through.
And in that regard, I think we should talk just a little bit about what's known as the he said, she said problem, where there's an employee making an accusation against another, and the other employee just denies it. And these are some of the most challenging circumstances, I think, for employers and HR professionals. And in given the momentum of the Me Too movement and the increasing number of workplace harassment complaints that employers are receiving and obligated to investigate and remedy, I think this is going to be more and more of a concern. So when you talk about having enough evidence upon which to base a termination decision, how do you talk to clients about weighing up the he said, she said circumstances?
Well, that's a challenging situation. When you have that situation, you're going to need to make a credibility decision about who you believe in most cases.
How do you do that?
That can be tough. There are only two people in the room when the comment was made or whatever happened is alleged to have happened, and there are two completely conflicting stories. Then you need to look at, is there any supporting evidence? Are there any corroborating witnesses to back up at least part of the story? And you really need to do as thorough an investigation as you can. And at some point, you're going to need to make a decision about who's telling the truth. And I guess the important thing to think about is there's no way you can ever tell for sure that you're completely right, but you don't have to be. You just need to make a good faith, thorough investigation.
And that's a point that I'd like to urge to employers. You don't have to sit on your hands feeling like you can't make a decision because there's not a third person as a witness. Sometimes all you have is an allegation of one person, and there is no third party witness. There's a denial by the accused. And just like you said, Mark, you've got to make judgments about credibility. Who has a motive for saying what they're saying? Whose behavior is consistent with the notion that they're telling the truth or not telling the truth? Sometimes you got to you got to rely a little bit on how people have behaved in the past to make your best judgment about how they probably behaved in this circumstance. And when you add it all up, you make your best judgment and you go forward and you live with it. That leaves us with two more questions, and these are really key to the ultimate notion of fairness. Number six is, has the employer applied its rules and its penalties in an even-handed way without discrimination? How should the employer basically assess this question number six?
Well, you want to treat like cases alike in general. You want to look at the past practice and treatment of other employees in comparable situations and make sure that the employee in question isn't being treated worse than comparable employees. And that is obviously a way to avoid a potential discrimination case. Let's say you've got an excessive absenteeism situation, and your rule is after 10 absences, you're going to be 10 occurrences, you're going to be terminated. Well, if you're ready to terminate someone, you want to check out what's really happening with other employees who are comparable. If you find out that other employees have 12 occurrences and they haven't been terminated, then you probably want to rethink the decision, because there's a potential for the employees saying they're being treated inconsistently or worse than comparable employees, and possibly, depending on who it is, a discrimination case.
And Mark, that takes us to the seventh and last question that we're going to talk about. And I think in many ways, it's really where the rubber meets the road on thinking about the fairness of a possible firing decision. And that question is, does termination fit the crime?
Yeah, they call termination the capital punishment of employment law. So it is obviously the most serious type of action you can take. And you really want to look at all the six previous questions and the severity of the act when deciding whether the punishment fits the crime. There was a Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals case a few years ago where the employer terminated an employee for taking a coworker's bag of taco chips at lunch. And the court in that case concluded that really wasn't quite serious enough to terminate someone. So they thought there might have been another reason why the employer made that decision, and it might have been unlawful. And a great quote from that case is that, from this molehill of taco chips, the employer endeavored to make a mountain. And so you don't want to do that.
Right. I mean, lawyers talk about the conventional wisdom of bad facts make bad law. And, you know, you don't want to go to a court case and try to defend a termination that was for some petty offense. And I think the real challenge is most of us can identify those offenses that aren't serious enough to merit a termination. But the circumstances of a serious offense might also have to be considered. For example, think about sleeping on the job. If somebody falls asleep at a machine and jeopardizes the health and safety of their coworkers in violation of a no sleeping rule, maybe that justifies a termination. But if somebody nods off in the break room when they're on the third day of pulling double shifts because the company's understaffed and they've been willing to take the extra overtime, that's a little different and maybe doesn't justify termination. So I think thoughtful employers have to think not only of what's the offense, but what are the circumstances of the offense?
That's a good point. And one final point, Bud, is that when making this decision, you also can consider whether there's any mitigating circumstances. You may have an employee who arguably engaged in something that's worthy of termination, but they've got a long history of good performance or other differentiating facts that may make you think, well, maybe we can do something a little less severe.
Good. Thank you, Mark. With that, let's wrap it up. We hope that those guidelines, those questions are useful to you employers to assess the fairness of your potential discharge decisions. Mark, thank you for doing the podcast with me.
Thank you very much, Bud.
And to all of our listeners, thank you for your time and attention. Have a great day.
Thank you for joining us on the Ogletree Deacons podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts on iTunes or through your favorite podcast service. And remember, the information in this podcast is for informational purposes only and is not to be construed as legal advice.